Here's what's coming today on the Woodworking Network podcast.
I've gotten to live with my own stuff, and I've seen how it can change my habits, change my life, change my outlook, and I kind of want to bring that out to other people, both in the way of selling my goods, but also kind of training employees, because it's not just the furniture, it's also the making of the furniture that has kind of informed the way I live.
Welcome to this episode of the Woodworking Network podcast. Join us as we explore the business of woodworking, big and small, and what it takes to succeed. I'm Will Sampson.
Well, I'm Will Sampson from Woodworking Network and FDMC Magazine, and we are live today at the Wood Pro Expo in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I have as my guest Brian Skolaski, who is the winner of our 2025 Young Wood Pro contest. Congratulations, Brian.
Thank you.
You have a beautiful piece. We have it up on the screen here, and it's been in the magazine and everything. Tell us about the piece that you made.
So this piece came from a longtime patron's request. He had, because of the emerald ash borer, he had to cut down a bunch of trees on his property. And so there was some ash and some walnut. He kind of just handed me a bunch of boards. And he was like, do something. I had made him a liquor cabinet maybe 3 or 4 years beforehand. So he was like, we have this wood that came from the family property. Can you make two more for my sons? Like, and this was in, let's say 2022. So, and when I was in college, I had started exploring steam bending through like a series of experiments. And I'd always had this one hanging on the wall that, you know, it catches my eye every once in a while.
An experiment where you bend something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're all over my shop, all kinds of little bits and bobs of, you know, and they're all just kind of potential ideas. So I'd been staring at this one for a while, and I always knew it was a tambour cabinet handle. I was like, okay, that'll go somewhere someday. So I get all this wood back to my shop, and I grab that thing. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this is what we're doing. And especially with ash, which steam bends so well, and you know. So a lot of the inspiration is also around the very kind of nature of wood. So a lot of the inspiration for the handle comes from like the way, if you were to split firewood and you kind of see,
follow the grain
right, around a right, knot. So right, essentially it's kind of a door handle based on a knot. And then jumping off from that, I'm like, okay, so we've got a knot. We've got ash, we've got walnut. So we can kind of do a heartwood, sapwood kind of combination by making the outside light, inside dark, kind of get this sort of tree aspect to it visually.
Neat. And then when you open the tambour doors, there's lighting inside. That's really neat too. LED lighting on that, right?
Yeah. LED strip lights that are routed into the top panels. So
very cool. Very cool. Well, it's a really nice piece. And then the top is
I believe it's slate.
Slate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, stone top. It's very nice. It's got a blue-gray tone to it, and it contrasts nicely with the ash timbre, and then the interior. What's the interior?
Oh, that's all walnut.
Yep. Walnut, yeah. So you got three nice colors working together. That's really great. Yeah. So how did you get started woodworking, Brian?
That's a depends on where you want to put the starting
point. How early?
Point.
Yeah. what was your first woodworking experience?
I mean, that was mainly with my dad down our basement. He always had kind of a, you know, put together the hobbyist wood shop down there that I probably took over by the time I was about 14. So I always kind of played around down there, had various little projects, but when I got to be 13 or 14, all of my friends started skateboarding and stuff, and I was like, well, I've got a wood shop and a skateboard is wood.
So you're going to make a skateboard?
I could do this.
Great.
So I did that for a while. I think I made about 30 of them over a four-year period thereabouts. So it was
Is that where you first had wood bending experience, bending the decks?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that was more of like a bent lamb situation. I was actually, so it wasn't like your standard skateboard with the two tails. It was longboards.
Right.
So
okay.
They have like a camber to them so that when you stand on them, they flatten.
Right.
And then they've got kind of a little bounce when you ride them. So it was like a whole series of, I mean, my dad's an engineer, so we already had AutoCAD on the computer. And I was able to kind of create this rib system to press them and then moved on from there. But eventually I made one for a friend whose dad was a cabinet maker, and he's like, yeah, I can put you to work.
Oh, that's so great.
Yep, you know, I had my first woodworking job at 16 and at a Minster and Company cabinetry in Easton. So
cool. And then you took classes in school, right? And did you have high school wood shop?
No, they
you didn't have
no,
high school wood shop.
They didn't. There was a polytech program, but I was kind of in the music department, and that kind of conflicted, so I wasn't. And they didn't really have, I mean, I could have done something like carpentry related, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And
but you went on to Bucks Community College.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And did woodworking there.
Yep. So, yeah, it was funny. They wouldn't even let me leave high school to go work in a cabinet shop, which I thought was funny.
That's typical counterproductive public school system.
Yeah, it got to the point where my one English teacher, if I didn't have my homework, he was like, what, you forget it in a cabinet or something?
right.
So.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a better excuse than the dog ate it.
Yeah, it just went right through the table saw.
There you go. Oh, and then from Bucks College, you went on to Rhode Island School of Design?
Yep. Yeah, so
that's a great school.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. It was kind of funny because when I got, I didn't realize what it was. Even when I got there, my teacher at Bucks, Mark Sfeary, had just recommended, he's like, look, I don't know if you'll get in, but if you do, do whatever you have to go there, because he was a graduate of that program back in the, I guess it was probably the 80s when Tate Frid was in charge of the program.
Yeah.
So he was like, yeah, that's the place to go if you can get in. So I got there and I'm like, looking around, I'm like, okay, I'm at art school.
That's great. I knew Tay Frid when I was editor of Fine Woodworking magazine, and I always got a kick out of him because he was always so down to earth, and the one phrase I always associate with him is if there was something that he didn't like, he says, oh, that Mickey Mouse. Yeah, it was great. Mm-hmm. And then you have, besides working in the cabinet shop, you also apprenticed with a pretty prominent woodworker, too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Hank had plenty of...
Hank Gilpin.
Yep. He had plenty of Tay Frid stories, too.
Yeah,
so.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah. That's kind of a turning point in my own work, in that before then I was kind of doing a lot more straight line kind of tapers and sort of stuff like that. And he really turned me on to, curvature and hand shaping and all sorts of stuff that kind of gets incorporated back into my work now.
Sculptural design concepts.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't think I've looked at pictures of my work pre that period in such a long time, because I look at it and I'm like, I made that? Huh. it's just like kind of a past life almost.
That's funny. Well, we all go through stages in woodworking, I think, where we certain design motifs appeal to us. So the curves are definitely interesting. But, this cabinet is great with the not just the curves on the door handles, but just the curve of the timbre as it goes around. Mm-hmm. And then also people that have an opportunity to see it up close. I didn't really appreciate it until I saw it in person. The grain matching on the front of the cabinet is just really great. How did you accomplish that?
So I had a bunch of 8-quarter stock. So all of that is actually kind of book matched around the whole cabinet. And then there was quite a bit of stain work involved, actually, because the poles are steam bent. So once you steam bend them, they're kind of a different color, similar to you know, steamed walnut versus unsteamed.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to bring a little color back in, and then some of the boards had some variations. So there's actually a good bit of stain work that I don't think it's apparent, but maybe it is.
No, I think you did a spectacular job of matching it. It looks all continuous all across the front.
Mm-hmm.
There was one guy that stopped by. We have the piece in the booth here at the show, and one guy stopped by the booth and was looking at it and you know, was figuring that you had to, you know, saw all those pieces. And he's wondering, you know, what kind of a saw did he use to get really thin curves, because everything matches. You can see the early wood and late wood grain flow across, you know, and mm-hmm. there's really no interruptions and all. Although I would suspect that some of that is lining up and down and vertical to make things match as closely as possible.
Oh yeah, there was a fair bit of thought into all of that, and you know, some magic that I won't.
Not going to reveal your trade secrets,
yeah.
Even at your ripe young age. What are you, 31 now?
Yep, 31.
31. All right. Well. Now you're operating a one-person shop, basically. Now,
mm-hmm.
What's the name of your company?
Jürgen Studio.
Okay.
It's kind of a nod to the German Art Nouveau style. It was called Jugendstil, so it's kind of a nod to that. Makes sense with my
work. Somebody looking it up online, they'll look at it as jug end, but he's pronouncing it with the original language there. So what kind of, are you doing all furniture, or are you doing cabinets, you're doing built-ins, what are you doing?
I do what keeps the lights on these days.
That's probably a good tactic for somebody starting out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty varied work. Most of the jobs that I've, so we've had some refinishing, because I have a finisher that works for me part-time who's, I mean, incredible. I've never seen anybody like him. Frank Jones. He kind of learned from an older school of finishing with Japan colors and all sorts stuff that you don't see very often anymore. So we got a good bit of refinishing work coming through. Then we have a couple residential kind of cabinetry jobs. And then one of those we got, though, because they had kind of an interesting request where they had purchased an old, like, turn-of-the-century library and, like, wall paneling. So it's an architect couple. So mm-hmm. the wife wanted to refit this into her Philadelphia row home. So mm-hmm. we're currently going through and trying to figure out, like, I mean, it's a whole mod podge of, like, the casework is poplar, the wall paneling is mahogany, there's some pine thrown in and out. I kind of think it's from, like, three different rooms, and they all just sold it together.
Put it together, yeah.
So it's kind of taking
three different eras.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. So it's been interesting to stitch all of that together into, like, one cohesive room, so.
Huh, what a challenge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a head scratcher sometimes.
I think you told me too. Speaking of challenges, that you had worked on a Frank Lloyd Wright restoration project. What was that about?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that was with my old employer, Brian Boland of Boland Woodworking. That was when I first started work. Actually, it's probably the reason I ended up working for him, because I walked into the shop and he's just got Frank Lloyd Wright pieces all over the place, and I'm like, okay,
oh, wow.
Yeah, this is where I need to work. So I believe what happened was the Beth Shalom Synagogue got a grant from the, I can't remember who, whether it was the Frank Lloyd Wright Conservancy or I think it had also been recently designated as a national landmark. So mm-hmm. they were looking to put in the money to restore it. And it's kind of an ongoing project. But it was one of the, I guess it must have been one of the last jobs Frank Lloyd Wright did, because he died before the completion of it.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
But yeah, it was done in the early 60s, and really incorporated a lot of kind of the plywood furniture that he was working with in that era. Really interesting stuff with all kinds of like penny pointing details and kind of these like cut out little triangles and everything. It's a really incredible space. And I think, I'm not sure where they are with it right now.
So it's still an ongoing project.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the main problem is there is a very leaky big glass roof. So the reason the furniture needed to be refinished was because, I mean, it was all completely sun damaged, water damaged, and so like a lot of the veneers were flaking off and stuff.
Oh, that's terrible. So,
I mean, how long is furniture supposed to really last, you know? And granted, it's Frank Lloyd Wright, so we'll make it last as long as we can, but
yeah.
It was probably a lot of new technology that they were kind of testing out, and that was really the ringer with the sun bleaching and the water damage.
Yeah, that's a real challenge. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how, you know, are you trying to make your furniture be heirloom furniture that lasts a lifetime? Is that the goal?
I mean, that's always the goal. You don't, I haven't met anyone that wants their work to fall apart in 10 years, so.
Right, right. At least anybody that's honest and.
yeah, maybe there are a few now that I think of it, but yeah, I mean, I think furniture to me informs kind of the way you live. Like, there was a lot of that in the cabinet piece. A lot of that had to do with this kind of juxtaposition of the cabinet open versus closed,
mm-hmm.
and kind of the implications of that, right? So if you go to somebody's house and, you know, there's a open liquor cabinet with interior lighting,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of an invitation.
There you go.
So I kind of had this idea designing it where it's like, okay, it's going to look good closed. You mm-hmm. know, you work through your day, you look at your cabinet, 5 o'clock rolls around, you open it up, the lights come on.
And looks good open.
Yep. And you just keep it open, you know, and then end of the night, right back closed.
Go. Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, folks of your generation who are not woodworkers seem to be having less interest in what we would call heirloom furniture. Particularly, they're not interested in antiques, they're not interested in older furniture. What makes you cut a different path?
Well, I don't know. I think there's still an interest in antique furniture. It's just kind of changing. I mean, there are so many people out there refinishing mid-century pieces that.
Oh, right, right.
I think we've just, the era of what's considered vintage might not be considered vintage to someone, you know, in their 70s. It's like, oh, that's the furniture I grew up with. That's not like period furniture. But for us, I think it's just kind of changing in that way, and that what used to be seen as vintage is now historical, maybe.
Yeah, so. I talked once with Ned Cook at Yale, who is a furniture historian. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was trying to get him to nail down, and it was something he'd really never thought about until we started discussing it, was 200 years ago in what some people would consider the, you know, golden age of furniture production in America, how much of a household's income was devoted to furniture. Mm-hmm. And the percentage would work out to be way more than what it is now. And what the furniture makers were getting would be a much higher level than it is now. Because, quite frankly, there wasn't much else to buy. Mm-hmm. You know, think about in your, you know, modern house, you have all of these electronic appliances there, you know, the from the kitchen appliances to your entertainment appliances to computers, all of this stuff. You know, we're carrying a expensive computer in our pockets most of the day for most people. Mm-hmm. And that's all part of their disposable income.
Yeah.
And going back 200 years, furniture was what it was. I mean, mm-hmm. hell, there wasn't really even a kitchen per se in houses back then.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do also with, I mean, how often people move nowadays, you know?
That's true.
It's kind of, if especially if you have, like, especially nowadays with remote work and all of this other stuff, I mean, plenty of people I know never stay put in a place for 5 years, and it's like, well, yeah, okay, you're definitely not going to have a 1,000-pound china cabinet then.
Right, 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 right.
So, but I do think, I mean, people still do want to have this kind of, you know, heirloom furniture. I think the focus of it has gone on to more, well, really tables, I think. I think a lot of it is that cabinetry kind of, or at least like, you know, standalone china cabinets, hutches, mm-hmm. you know, drop-down desks, that sort of stuff fell out of fashion just based on the way a home is laid out nowadays, you know?
Yeah, and what you're going to be using the home for. But yeah, there has been a resurgence in custom tables. What bothers me about that is most of them, they just make the tables. They don't make any chairs to go with the tables.
Yep.
And I suspect that's because chairs are difficult.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's also, given, you know, my generation's limited financial mobility, you'll end up spending more on the chairs than you will on the table most
right.
times.
Right.
So it's like, okay, we can have one big, you
really
know,
nice statement table.
Yeah, and we'll buy up some old Tonnet chairs and throw them around and call it a day.
kind of sad.
Yeah.
Matt Buell, who is the host of the Young Wood Pro program that we do with Grizzly Industrial. He does tables, but he also really, really likes to do chairs. Mm-hmm. And he always does the chairs to go with the tables. And that's kind of different from a lot of folks that I see that are, particularly the ones that have capitalized on the fad for the resin river tables and you know, live edge stuff, which mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a huge fan of.
Yep, you are preaching to the choir.
I mean, some of them look great, but how much of that can you do? And
yeah, and what happens when the wood moves and the epoxy doesn't and all that?
Yeah, no, there's definitely issues there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and to me, and I don't know if this appeals to you too, but a piece of furniture that I really like is going to be one that I can look at it and come back to it over and over again and see something new that I didn't see before that was really interesting about the design and how it was done.
Mm-hmm.
That little details that you have to live with the piece before you even realize they're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a fun thing that I learned from Hank Gilpin was he would always say, I put silly little details underneath tables where no one will see them.
That's interesting.
So, like, even if he was just doing little button blocks, they'd be, every surface would be shaped, perfect, you know, yeah, crowned out, yeah, every little thing. Yeah. I mean, you know, you could live with the thing for 30 years and then finally put your head under it and be like, oh, I didn't know that was there.
Yeah, yeah. When I was at Fine Woodworking Magazine for a while, in my office, we had one of, I don't know if you know Garrett Hack from Vermont, but we had one of his pieces that we were using for cover photography on the magazine, and it, so I got to live with it in my office for a month or two. And one of the beautiful things was, it was a little sideboard, and it had three banks of small drawers, but the drawers very subtly changed size as they went down the piece into the sides, and you know, it was a very subtle thing, but they weren't all the same size, and it just fit with the piece and gave it a certain motion that you wouldn't have in, you know, just a piece where all the drawers were the same size and sitting there, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting how, I mean, even just kicking a leg out 2 degrees off 90 degrees completely just changes the feel of anything.
Now, when you're making a piece for those kinds of things and stuff, do you mock up anything beforehand, or is it all drawings? Do you use AutoCAD or pencil? What's your design process?
Well, let's see. Usually we go sketchbook, then import that into AutoCAD just so that I can kind of nail down my crucial measurements and make sure the table's tall enough and all of that sort of stuff. But fortunately, since most of what I'm doing is steam bending, there's probably more than one failure piece. So usually by the time I've got my bending process down, I have enough parts to put together a mock-up and kind of fine-tune a lot of the details. So, for example, recently I did a trestle table with these kind of splayed out legs, and basically I just broke enough pieces that I was like, oh, I can't use these. These have cracks, but like, they'll do fine enough. So that gave me an opportunity to just test out all of my joinery for all of that, figure out how much the legs need to be splayed and stuff. So even when the AutoCAD drawing is done, it's all up in the air, you know. There's a certain point where you kind of leave the drawing wherever it is because you're working in real time now, so.
Right, making adjustments on the fly. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting. And now when you work with a client to make something, do you have a back and forth on the design, or do you get carte blanche from the client to basically create something, or how does it work?
I usually come up with, well, it's both design and price point kind of thing, where it's, you know, I try to do good, better, best in that, like, okay, here's something that incorporates my style and aesthetic, and it's probably, you know, this is the lower end model. Here's all the bells and whistles, and then here's kind of your middle of the road thing. And then usually it's a back and forth with the client of, oh, I like something from the bells and whistles. Can we throw that on this one or something like that? So it's a lot of, it's both kind of design and cost engineering all rolled into one.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, it's, you know, I know that it is a challenge when you're starting out to, you don't necessarily have a reputation and trying to negotiate with the customers and that sort of thing to try and do what's true to your design sense, but also meets their needs and their budget.
Yeah. I mean, I think any good designer, I mean, design's the challenge, you know? What you should still be able to come up with something that makes your client happy and is something that you're proud to produce. And I think if you're just kind of trying to design, you know, your big magnum opus piece and trying to get somebody to pay for it, that's just kind of bad design.
There you go. Yeah, I always liked working with people to solve their problems with my designs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's sort of one of the parts that I get the most out of it. So how do you find customers? You're starting out, you know, what where do you get business?
Yeah, I mean, for more of the furniture stuff of my own design, that's mostly word of mouth and, you know, promotion through things like this. Mm-hmm. The casework stuff, my old boss, Brian Boland, he kind of got me in with a few designers, and it was kind of like, look, here's a few people that, you know, and there are people that I worked with while I was with him,
mm-hmm.
and kind of developed.
So they know your
with.
Work, and
yeah, exactly. Yeah. They know that, you know, I was the one that produced it there. I met them installing it and stuff like that. So.
And then you'll show up on time and deliver the goods.
Yes, exactly. So he definitely gave me a good head start in that kind of aspect. So that's kind of the work that keeps the lights on and the bills paid and
mm-hmm.
my fridge full.
There you go.
And then I try
all important things.
Yep. And then I try and weave in all of the furniture and the fun stuff and the refinishing, which takes care of any of those holes in your schedule when, you know, the plumbing inspection doesn't go the way they thought and you're behind by 2 months now.
Oh, jeez, yeah. Yeah, Mr. Murphy is always causing trouble. Yeah, yeah. So what's your long-term goals? Are you looking to, you know, get employees and be a bigger shop, or you want to continue as a sole proprietor, or how do you want to work?
I'm mid pivot right now because I'll be moving to Oregon in the spring, so that's thrown an interesting wrench in my planning process. But I think since furniture kind of informs the way you live, the more of it you get out there, the more successful at that goal you are. You know,
right.
I kind of want to see people live. I mean, I've had the fortunate, I've gotten to live with my own stuff, and I've seen how it can change my habits, change my life, change my outlook. And I kind of want to bring that out to other people,
mm-hmm.
both in the way of selling my goods, but also kind of training employees, because it's not just the furniture, it's also the making of the furniture that has kind of informed the way I live.
Now, what part of the process is your favorite part of the process? Is it the design? Is it the actual fabrication? What do you like best?
Oh, I'll always love the fabrication the most. It's really, and I mean, that's kind of why I headed towards steam bending, is just it has this experimental aspect to it where you can think you know what it'll do and you can take your best guess, but it'll always
doesn't always
surprise
work.
You. So that's really where I thrive. But I mean, my design process is so rooted in that in the first place, in that, you know, usually anything in my sketchbook started as one of these little models in my shop, or, you know, tests that was hanging on the wall. So they're kind of inseparable. So I don't necessarily think of it as like, oh yeah, I would rather be designing and send somebody off to make it. It's like, it all just kind of has to happen under one roof.
Can you describe the steam bending process and how you work it? Do you have a container? A lot of guys have like a PVC pipe, mm-hmm. or something like that. What do you do? How does it work?
So I usually, actually, I'll be teaching a class out at Mark Adams School of Woodworking.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
Out in the, what is that? I think it's August of next year.
It's out
year.
In Indiana.
Yep.
Mark is a great person to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my wife, Janine, she's a wood turner, and she's mm-hmm. taught out there before and kind of made that connection. And so I'll be out there. We're teaching a collaborative steam bending and basketry class.
Oh, okay.
But then I'm also doing a weekend class on how to build a steam box.
Oh, okay. So you've got a steam box, and then what do you use for the source of steam?
Just your standard little wallpaper steamer.
Oh, okay. And so then you feed the box with that, and mm-hmm. and how long does stuff have to stay in the box?
It
depends on the
yeah, it depends on temperatures, thickness, especially since almost everything I'm bending is tapered in one way or the mm-hmm. other. So it's kind of like, okay, we're going to put the thick end towards the source of the steam and then kind of guesstimate halfway in between and see how it works. So
what kind of temperatures does it get up to?
It's usually around 210, 220. It's nothing too crazy. Although I have heard of people who build pressurized steam chambers.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little, the line between a pressurized steam chamber and a explosion in your shop is a fine one, so I haven't quite dabbled in that.
I've been in a couple of factories that do steam bending on a a production scale, mm-hmm. like doing like chair parts and things like that. One of them was actually an Amish company that started making parts for Amish buggies, mm-hmm. and then now it's very industrial, and they have these huge fixtures to do various bending, and the stuff comes out, you know, at like 270 degrees or something
Wow.
like that, and then, you know, you can't really touch it, and they put it in a fixture and have hydraulic stuff that's mm-hmm. moving parts around and making these shapes. And,
yeah.
You know, do you have forms that you'll find do stuff around, or are you hand bending, or how are you bending it once you get it out of your box?
It kind of depends on thickness for the most part. So yeah, anything up to like half inch, you can just kind of pull it out of the steam tube and kind of tie it in a knot or do whatever you need to with mm-hmm. it. But then as you get further and further up, you know, I mean, that shop that you were in was probably bending what, like 4-inch stock or something like that.
Oh, bending all sorts of different size
yeah.
stuff. Yeah.
So at that point, you're really, it's really more of an engineering problem because you have to build a jig that doesn't implode on you through all of this crazy force.
Right.
Like the dining table I was talking about had like the legs were probably 3.5 inches at the thickest part. So it was like lag bolts, a solid 6-inch form of plywood. I actually had to upgrade to spring steel for the strap
because mm-hmm.
otherwise the wood would actually stretch out the strap too much and you would get fracturing on the outside face. So, yeah, at a certain point, it's like, am I woodworking anymore?
Well, you know, you have to understand the nature of the wood because, mm-hmm. You know, on the outside of a bend, you're stretching the wood, and on the inside of the bend, you're compressing the wood.
Mm-hmm.
And those fibers can, you know, they can rupture either way, but it's a different kind of rupture mm-hmm. in either case. So.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you get to the thick stuff and you're like, I mean, I have some lag bolts that you can tell exactly where they exit the mold because they've got like a 15-degree angle just from the force of the strap
yeah.
and everything. So it's a matter of also designing molds that you can use more than once without them falling apart, essentially. It's been an interesting ride to get there. Because I really started more bending probably stuff in that like kind of 1/4 to 1/2 inch range, which was like, that's a lot more free. I mean, that's kind of what you
well,
see on the cabinet doors.
Yeah, the cabinet, the one is like what, 1/2 inch pieces or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, something like 3/8 maybe, something
yeah,
like that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. I met a woodworker once who had a portable bending setup that he took to job sites and used, and he would sometimes at lunch breaks he would entertain kids in the neighborhood that came by making little wood pretzels.
Oh, yep.
So what are you working on right now?
Right now, well, yeah, I've got the I'll be delivering a kitchen in 2 weeks, so that's going through assembly. And then the the office with all of the period casework. So that's really the big thing on my plate right now. And then there's also another blueprint match wall paneling job that's probably going to filter in sometime in December, I think.
So you're keeping busy.
Yeah, more than busy.
and when is the, is there a date for the move to Oregon?
When everything's done.
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
3,000 mile move.
Yeah, yeah. I have a few pieces of machinery that I just can't part with.
Yep.
And that's kind of driving the whole thing.
So. Well, and I gather you haven't collected your prize from Grizzly for the contest because you probably want it delivered to Oregon.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Grizzly won't complain because they're just up, you know, the road in Washington. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fascinating, and I love talking with you. I love your piece. For folks that are here at the show, it is at the show, and you can come and check it out and open and close the doors and look inside, and it's a great piece. And we wish you luck, Brian, in your future endeavors, and we'll definitely stay in touch.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
It's great.
That's it for today. If you are looking for more of our podcasts, you can find all of them at woodworkingnetwork.com/podcasts and in popular podcast channels. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. Thanks again to today's sponsor, FDMC Magazine. If you have a comment or topic you'd like us to explore, contact me at will.sampson@woodworkingnetwork.com. Thanks for listening.